Insiders and outsiders, from academic martyrs to gays and lesbians in the military, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations featuring the controversial views of two scholars. Theologian Stanley Hauerwas will discuss gays and lesbians in the American military. Before that, critic Stanley Fish tells why academics love to suffer.
Yes, I'm not sure that all priests or religious persons have the commitment to suffering that academics do. So that if it's a priesthood we're talking about in that line at least, then academics would be the purest of the type.
Mm-hmm.
Because suffering is not so much a part of their religion or a way station on the way to the goal of their religion. Suffering is the academic religion.
Critic Stanley Fish of Duke University. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about academic martyrs and why scholars love to suffer. Later on the program, theologian Stanley Hauerwas talks about religion and sexual orientation in the American military. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center, with partial support from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Most of us would agree that university professors occupy a special status in American society, something like an ancient priesthood. But according to one inside observer, although medieval priests and nuns saw suffering as a part of their religion, many academics today have made suffering a religion unto itself. Stanley Fish is a professor of law and literature at Duke University. In a recent article entitled "The Unbearable Ugliness of Volvos," Stanley Fish describes this phenomenon and writes about modern-day academic martyrs. For instance, he says that one reason university professors like to drive the boxy Swedish cars is because they secretly cherish an inverse relationship between virtue and success. The uglier the car, the more virtuous the driver. This is even a logic that extends to the academic conference circuit. I asked Stanley Fish to explain.
Yes, and in fact, the people who inflict this suffering on one another, because this is something mutual, everyone has to be complicit in this for it to work, or in this sense, for it not to work. The people who inflict this suffering on one another do so with a sense of, how shall we say, triumphant apology.
Uh-huh.
That is, people who guide you around on a campus and bring you to the hotel in which your reservation has not been made, or to the lecture room which is locked or occupied by another scholar or another class, always say in a kind of giggly fashion, oh, well, these things happen. And you get the sense that the fact that these things happen and that efficiency is entirely lacking in the process is a matter of pride.
Well, now, I could accuse you of sounding like H. Ross Perot. In other words, transferring the world of business, that ethic, into the academy, efficiency, clarity, purpose. You write here, for were the process to be efficient, it would be too much like the world of business, and the investment in being distinguishable from business is so great that academics will pay any price to protect it.
Yes, I think that's true. That is, the word Philistine comes to mind here, because it's always Philistine is the word that is hurled back at you whenever you complain of the inefficiency and quaint eccentricity that marks academic exchanges. I remember once being called before the board of the then-fledgling union at the University of California at Berkeley in 1963 or 4, and asked why it was that I was not interested in joining the union. And I pointed out that the union, as far as I could tell, had a series of policy positions, none of which were directed toward me. They were for student rights. They took various foreign policy positions. This particular union was against parking on campus, etc. And I pointed out that what I was interested in was job security, working conditions, some kind of sense of salary, wages, and benefits. And I was interrupted by someone who said, "But you don't believe in, you don't belong in a university. You might as well be working for the Teamsters."
All of this goes to underscore what is the old adage that academic politics are so vicious because the stakes are so low.
That's the old adage, but the old adage, in fact, is false. My own department, which is a department of 34 members, has traveling through its budgetary lines each year, $5 million.
Goodness gracious.
$5 million is not, at least in my parlance,
that's a corporation.
A small amount. The arts and science budget for my university, just in the division of which I'm a member, is, I think, $300 million.
Uh-huh.
Again, so that it doesn't seem to me that the extraordinary devotion to inefficiency that marks the academy can be supported by the thesis that the stakes are low unless someone has a very odd idea of what $300 million is.
Tell me about academics and their administrators. You say that they want to, well, tell me what they
well,
want
actually,
and what they really, really want.
The truth about academic administration follows from what I've already said. That is, the disdain for those values which are thought of as the values of business, efficiency, and so forth. Therefore, academic administrators tend to be inefficient and unpracticed in what they do and proud of it. Indeed, academic administrators must perform badly, lest it be suspected that they enjoy what they are doing, because the general line is that one would only want to go into administration and do well at it if either one's if one was a burnt-out case or one's fires had never been stoked up in the first place. And
so,
therefore, in order to validate your academic credentials as an administrator, and as an administrator, you have to be absolutely hapless as an administrator.
And the logic here leads us in the direction of what you write, that academics get the administrators not that they deserve, but that they want.
Yes, and they
and that,
want...
that comes from all this suffering.
Yes, they want the academics, they want administrators who do display the inefficiency and inadequacy which validates their superior interior qualities.
Uh-huh.
It also has the inestimable advantage of allowing them to heap up the treasure that is most dear to the academic heart, and that is the treasure of complaint. That is, the worse the administrator is, the more they have to complain of, the happier academics are.
What about academics and where they keep their eyes?
Ah, yes.
The
well,
horizon,
you see,
close and far.
One of the things that you know when you're an academic is that you must always have your eye on the far horizon. That is, the ultimate emergence of truth, or the preserving and custodianship of the higher realms of art, literature, and philosophy. But of course, if you keep your eyes on that horizon, then everything that's going on right in front of your eyes becomes a matter of indifference, becomes ignored.
Easy to ignore.
So if you walk down a typical department hall, you'll find that all of the light bulbs are out. Because, of course, putting in a light bulb so that you could see what's in front of your eyes is an unworthy activity, as opposed to closing those same eyes and keeping and fixing them on the high horizon of eternity.
What about moral superiority and moral culpability? You've touched on this.
Well, this is one of the more interesting things that academics do because it's so convoluted. Academics like to feel morally superior, but of course, since they believe in an inverse relationship between virtue and success, that is, the less successful you are, the more virtuous you are,
right.
Moral superiority can only be achieved, again, through suffering or a sense of inadequacy. Therefore, academics are always wishing to be someone else. That is, academics are always saying to themselves, why aren't I, you know, a worker on the barricades? Why aren't I someone who is truly suffering in the world? Why am I allowed by an incredibly debauched society to sit around explicating poems?
Well, this is part of your argument, Stanley, for why academics take up causes, either theoretical or even practical mm-hmm. ones. Gays, you have a long list here. Gays and Arabs and blacks and women, the disenfranchised, Native Americans. Now, I'll ask you a serious question, Stanley. Are you saying that there really is a fundamental hypocrisy in a lot of this scholarship that's going on?
Well, I'm not sure that hypocrisy would be the word, and I certainly wouldn't, since you've turned serious on me, Wayne.
Just for a moment.
I wouldn't reject or even mildly criticize a huge amount of the scholarship being done. My interest is in the way in which academics since I've been in the profession for 30 years, have identified a succession of outsiders and then declared themselves in some way in a relationship of desire to those outsiders. We wish we could be like them. Unfortunately, we are by and large quite comfortable white males driving our Volvos, but in our hearts, we'd like to be out on the streets getting beat up, being manhandled and forced to panhandle, etc., etc. It's what I've called in other places the romance of marginalization.
Now, is there any prospect, Stanley, let's end on a semi-serious note, is there any prospect that this situation is going to reverse itself, that academics will learn to talk and love, talk with and love one another and be happy in their work?
Well, I wonder, because you've put your finger on it, since often at a point when giving talks like this, I have a motto, not a proverb, designed, of course, to set the audience's teeth on edge. I say, the academy, love it or leave it. but, of course, that, I think, is over-optimistic and even disingenuous on my part.
Because, that sounds like Archie Bunker.
Because the academy, in fact, you can only love it by hating it. Mm-hmm. And so if you left it, you would leave everything behind that is the source of your pain. And again, by the academic logic that I've been unfolding in this paper, you would be, in leaving your pain, leaving your pleasure. So I don't think that it's going to happen. I do think, for the third time, respond to your invitation to be at least slightly serious. I do think that that this is a moment when the academic tendency to embrace and welcome pain may be countered by the intention of many in the society to inflict pain on academics to a greater degree than we've seen in some years. I'm speaking, of course, of the large anti-university movement that has grown up in the past 2 years, and it's my hope, only a hope at this moment, that when academics see themselves so severely under attack by persons of genuine power, that they may find themselves less in love with the pain that they have been receiving than they have traditionally proven to be.
Stanley Fish, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I wish you well in your work as an English professor and as a law professor. What I want to know is, when are you going to start writing for Jay Leno and David Letterman?
I, in fact, would very much like to be able to speak to a larger audience than the audience of the academy. But it's a very difficult thing to do. Most academics would believe it was a matter of gearing down. No, no, no. It's an extraordinarily hard task. Moreover, for most academics, their inability to do it is once again a sign of their superior virtue. So were I ever to succeed in speaking to larger audiences, I would, of course, be drummed out of the academic core according to the very principles I've been describing today.
Well, let's assume that Soundings is a small step in the right direction. Stanley Fish, thanks for coming by and good luck in your work.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Insiders, outsiders, and sexual orientation in the American military. Join me now for a conversation with theologian Stanley Hauerwas of Duke University.
Well, I think Christians are a much more questionable group than gays when it comes to the military. I mean, I think that gays have done a great service for us all to figure out how they can get themselves banned as a group from the military, and I don't see why that can't happen to Christians.
Now, here's your pacifist inclination coming out.
Right. I mean, just think about Roman Catholics have this just war view.
Right.
Now, on a just war view, you'd think, well, that might raise questions about a standing army.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't sound like to me the kind of people you'd want in the military. Or even if they're in the military, then they have to worry about battlefield strategies. You don't want to hurt non-combatants and so on and so on. I mean, you ought to get rid of these kinds of people. That's my view.
Theologian Stanley Hauerwas of Duke University. In a recent article, he sets forth an incisive, if irreverent, response to the national debate about what to do with gays and lesbians in the American military. Headlining his article, "Christians Unfit for Military Service," Stanley Harawa speculates about what would happen if military leaders saw Christians rather than gays and lesbians as a threat to war and war-making. They might even go so far as to keep gays and lesbians in the service and at the same time throw the Christians out. But since that's not likely to happen anytime soon, Stanley Harawas argues that instead, our politicians and social leaders should re-examine the entire notion of toleration, of who's an insider and who's an outsider. This is an argument that goes to Harawas's critique of standing armies, the purposes of which are in direct conflict with any serious consideration of religion in our modern world. I asked Stanley Harawas to explain.
What's really happening is that the gays are being asked to pay symbolically for the moral incoherence of our society.
Be specific for me.
Well, people don't know why they marry or don't marry. They don't know why they have sex before marriage, after marriage, during marriage. We say we live in a culture that's characterized by monogamy. We're not monogamous. We're serially polygamous. So the one thing that people think they know is there's got to be something wrong with something called homosexuality. They don't have the slightest idea what's wrong with homosexuality, but it's got to be wrong.
Well, now, when you say, Stanley Harawas, that gay men and lesbian women have done a better job of defining themselves as a group and their behavior, does that mean that you condone what we call homosexuality?
That's a very complex question. I'm a Christian. I do not approve of promiscuity.
Mm-hmm.
So I prefer to handle the whole question in terms of how you think about promiscuity.
What you're doing is moving back a step and talking about discrimination, categorical discrimination.
Well, I'm for certain kinds of categorical discriminations. I just don't know why we have a group called gays or homosexuals that we say you're clearly wrong. Uh-huh. I don't know what gay or homosexuality is in and of itself. I think that's a deep mistake.
You say, for example, that if we were to exclude Christians from the military, there are many bases, there are many premises for doing this.
Oh.
They congregate at night.
That's right.
Hold hands, they get in circles, they do things that are, God knows what they're doing.
That's right. Every night, would you want these people in the barracks, you know, over in a corner holding hands with their heads bowed? What kind of disgusting activity is that? I mean, you know, besides it's us against them kind of
And what
of
about
views.
Christians in the shower?
Would you want to shower with these people? They're an evangelistic sect. You never know when they might try to baptize you. You know? And just think, I mean, you know, when they eat and eat their God, you know, and celebrate the Eucharist, they say they can't kill. I mean, that would mess up military strategies. I mean, they can't go to war at that time.
Let's come back to your notions, what you talk about in this piece about the Catholic, the Catholic variety of Christianity and the just war, that is to say that empowering soldiers to make the selection about who they're going to kill and who's going to live.
Well, it's a very complex matter, but if you train people well on just war practice, it is possible for the common foot soldier to say, no, I cannot obey that order.
Or for a bomber pilot to say, wait a minute, I'm not going to beat you. I'm going to make the selection here about where this smart bomb goes.
That's right. Or whether that maybe I can only use smart bombs. You can't ask me just to drop ordnance. Not that smart bombs turn out to be all that smart, but... of course, I mean, that's got to be the possibility of disobedience is intrinsic to just war views.
Well, now, Stanley, what you were doing here, satire aside, is you were coming back to this very serious argument that you make that religion, Christianity specifically, is far too serious a matter to leave to the politicians.
Oh, absolutely.
And the church has, in effect, surrendered itself to the politicians.
Right.
Now, put that in the framework of your views about gays and lesbians.
Well, all that I'm trying to do is help Christians through this satire feel that they are as odd as gays and lesbians. And that, I mean, that's how they ought to feel if you're going to be Christian. Because, as a matter of fact, you've got countercultural practices that are just as weird as what people associate, indeed a good deal more so than with gays and lesbians.
Now, is this going to, does this make of you something of a pariah in the circles that you move in, Stanley Hauerwas? I mean, after all, you are a serious professor of ethics and law at Duke University, and you're saying some pretty outrageous things here. How about it?
Well, G.K. Chesterton was always fond of saying, you know, Christianity hasn't failed, it's just not been tried. I mean, theologians are kind of bad poets. If we were talented, we would be poets. But what poets do is to try to remind people of the oddness of their everyday convictions. And so what I'm trying to do is just remind Christians of the oddness of their everyday convictions. I mean, Christians in America have forgotten that when Christians even used to go to just war in the Middle Ages, when they came back from killing, they were prohibited from the Eucharist for at least 3 years. They had to go through penitential discipline. Well, I think that that's a reasonable thing to think about, and that Christians have lost that sense of oddness is a deep shame. So all that I'm trying to do is to remind people of the extraordinary character of Christian convictions. That does put me in great tension with a good deal of mainstream Protestantism. I can't deny that.
You use a wonderful line in this piece. You talk about what you call the illusion of certainty when we make decisions about who we're going to discriminate against, who's going to be on the inside and the outside. I take it that this is part of your argument.
Yeah, I think that people feel the fragility of their moral beliefs today because they suspect that they are fundamentally arbitrary. And that becomes very hard in matters of morals because any moral convictions worth having means that you must expect innocent people to suffer for them. And do you want innocent people to suffer for arbitrary convictions? So people have this longing and hunger for certainty, which you just don't have. You can't have. Indeed, exactly to the extent that people want to guarantee their convictions is just at the time that they become the most arbitrary.
Stanley, do you think that we're moving in the right direction? Do you feel, in effect, optimistic about the presence or the role of gays and lesbians in our military as a kind of an emblem of the struggles that we are experiencing in our society with respect to what you call moral certainty?
There is no question that I was quite shocked by the outrage expressed by Clinton's suggestion that gays be integrated into the military with no question. And I suddenly realized that this really was a genuine symbolic issue because what was really at stake was it's not the strategic problems of integrating gays into the military. It's that if they're integrated in the military, then they are fully accepted in American society because nothing is more acceptable than the United States military.
Nothing is more conservative and representative of our culture.
And so, in effect, people are trying to maintain their excommunication when there is no grounds for their excommunication in terms of the purposes of the military, or of the wider American society. Now, I mean, I feel I was on a panel at the law school recently about should gays be allowed to be married. And I said, I can't imagine why they shouldn't suffer all the incoherences of American marriage law just like the rest of us do.
You sound like the late, great Sam Kinison.
But so I think that's true. I can't imagine any reason why they shouldn't be open to the same forms of degradation that goes with being in the United States military as anyone else. It's going to be very interesting. Then, of course, if you get a return to the draft law, if I were gay, I'd want to say, oh no, you shouldn't draft me. I'm gay. But all of these things will follow, and it is intrinsic into the American practices that there is no basis, once you believe in the freedom of the individual and supply the egalitarian presuppositions associated with something called the freedom of the individual,
right,
that any form of discrimination, any form of judgment will look like discrimination. And people simply have to face up to that in this society, and I don't have any deep objection to it. I mean, but it's a little like, I mean, recently the Supreme Court decision about you can't exclude religious groups from using school property and this kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't see how on the grounds of the Supreme Court are you also can't exclude the Ku Klux Klan. Now, I mean, those are incoherences that I believe we have that
are... You call yourself a libertarian, and you say that libertarianism is always just around the bend from what's the proper word here to use?
Anarchy.
Fascism? Anarchy.
But actually, I'm not a libertarian at all. I believe that that our society has deeply within it libertarian presuppositions that, when pushed hard enough,
that we really don't take seriously enough.
Right. Become deeply. Means the society itself becomes deeply incoherent because libertarianism is an incoherent position.
Well, Stanley Hauerwas, I want to thank you for these this quick overview of this piece that you have written about gays, and the title of the piece is Christians Unfit for Military Service. This ran nationwide in the Religious News Service. Stanley, you're a professor of theological ethics and a professor of divinity and law at Duke University. You just finished a fellowship here at the National Humanities Center. What's next on the burner?
Trying to finish the project that I came to the National Humanities Center to write.
All right. Well, listen, I'll invite you back and we'll do a session on that too. Stanley Hauerwas, good luck in your work.
Thank you so much.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guests were Stanley Fish and Stanley Hauerwas, both professors at Duke University and both recent scholars at the National Humanities Center. If you'd like a cassette tape of their comments, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 679. That's number 679. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Include $2 if you'd like to have a complete catalog of Soundings discussions. Next week, the perils and rewards of publishing in the United States. My guests will include novelist Doris Betts and two publishers, John MacArthur of Harper's Magazine and Shannon Ravenel of Algonquin Books. Until next week, at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.